From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Mike Pesca. Guy Raz is away. This week, we visit the Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., and is corn syrup by any other name still as sweet? The PR effort to change its name to corn sugar. Also, Charles Seif on the concept behind his new book, Proofiness, which argues you're more likely to believe me if I say we're 64 seconds into this podcast than 60. Plus, NPR's Stephen Thompson shares a few recent Song of the Day selections from NPR Music. That's on this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Mike Pesca, fresh from the Values Voter Summit. Values voters, they go by many names. The Christian right, they don't like that one. Social conservatives, they're fine with that. Evangelicals, some of their leaders like that term best, but it's not descriptive of their politics. A few of the speakers, like Newt Gingrich, who addressed the conference today, define value voters by defining who they're against.
On the one front, we have a secular socialist machine led by Obama, Pelosi, and Reid. And on the other front, we have radical Islamists who would fundamentally change this country into a system none of us in this room would recognize.
A few years ago, it was conventional wisdom that value voters were the most underexplained but potent force driving Republican and therefore national politics. Then, beginning in 2009, the Tea Party rage became all the rage. So where did the value voters go? Well, some of the most influential of them, have come here to the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint attempts to push through a crush of admirers and gawkers. He's just delivered a speech boasting of his slate of very conservative candidates who won Republican primaries. His slate, because DeMint is the highest-ranking office holder most identified with the Tea Party movement. His PAC, the Senate Conservatives Fund, has not only backed, but in some cases all but groomed candidates who've pulled off shocking primary victories in Alaska, Kentucky, and most recently in Delaware. These victories ensure, in DeMint's words,
we have some candidates, folks. This is no longer voting for the least worst on the ballot. We've got some candidates that we can be proud of that we know when they get to Washington that they're going to stand up and speak for you and the millions of Americans who for years have felt ignored.
DeMint is here to tell the values voters that the Tea Party victories are their victories too. The conference attendees seem to agree. A man offers, no, emphatically delivers a Bible into DeMint's hands and tells the senator God's blessed him. It seems like DeMint's being questioned by reporters from every Christian news outlet this side of the Davy and Goliath reruns on the Trinity Broadcasting Network. A reporter asks him if he has designs on a Senate leadership position or the presidency. DeMint's been riding a hot streak that had rivaled a pre-bubble hedge fund manager. He says there were 1 million ralliers on the Washington Mall 3 weeks ago. Scientific estimates put the number below a tenth that. But to him, the turnout showed the power of the Tea Partiers, who he's cultivated, who, he says, share the most important beliefs with the voters in this room. I get him alone for a moment, and I ask him about that. What do you think the difference is between the Tea Party members and the value voters?
There is a relationship, and I think there is a strong faith component in the Tea Party movement, but it's very different than what I've seen before or things like moral majority. They're not pushing religion. They're not even pushing morality. They just consider the bankruptcy as a moral issue.
Then do you think that the Tea Party and value voters are a sustainable coalition once we hopefully get past these tough economic times, the economic issues aren't in the forefront? Can the coalition, if you will, be fractured?
Well, I think, keep in mind, the Tea Parties are just the tip of an iceberg. There is an American awakening that for everyone who goes to a Tea Party rally, there are thousands of people who feel the same way. I don't think this is going to go away because power has shifted from Washington to the people, and I don't think they're going to let it go.
Wait a minute. If 1 million people showed up at the rally, and if there are 1,000 people for everyone who didn't show up, that would mean there are 1 billion Tea Party members, but there are only 300 million Americans. I'm checking your math here.
Well, I think when you get 1 million, it's a very different formula. But I find locally, if you get 500 people come out to a rally, just as you saw in Delaware, you probably had a few thousand Tea Party members in Delaware, but 10 times that many voted for her. So there is a connection there. The Tea Parties are more the activists, but millions of Americans feel the same way.
Back in the main ballroom, Michelle Bachmann has the crowd in rapt attention.
Until the ship sank from the point of impact, You see, this is the level of greatness.
Bachman, a two-term member of Congress from Minnesota, can take a story and turn it into a parable that hits all the crowd's concerns of faith, sacrifice, and military. At times, her voice seems to be on the verge of breaking, but she holds it together.
Link of liberty, forged chain by chain, from generation to generation. It has never been easy. It has never been free. And so now it's ours. Now it's ours.
If Bachman's performance was all whispered awe, Senator Jim Inhofe's was brass tacks. He told the assembled, "I'm not going to talk about health care or the deficit. I'm here to talk about military readiness."
This administration is trying to destroy every institution that makes America different from other countries.
Specifically, he says, there's a defense authorization vote coming up on Tuesday. He says that riding on the vote would be the destruction of the 17-year-old compromise that allowed gays to quietly serve in the military.
I didn't think it'd work at that time, but it did. It was called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's something that if you are gay and you want to serve in the military, they don't ask about it, you don't tell it, you're not doing it openly, so that there are the problems that we all know about. And I think that they mentioned in my introduction that I was an Army veteran, and I think any of the veterans in this room, I don't have to tell you the problems that would happen if you have an open gay situation there where it allows people to use the military as a forum for their liberal agenda.
Afterward, I talked to Inhofe and brought up the bit about the Obama administration destroying the institutions that make America great. Then you started talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I thought that was interesting because one of the arguments that people make for allowing homosexuals in the military is, look at all these other countries that allow it. Look at England, look at France, and they say it doesn't hurt them. But are you saying that the difference, that America doesn't allow it, is something that we should preserve and that we should celebrate, that it makes us different?
First of all, I don't agree with you. All other countries do. They have different standards. But I'm not going to emulate other countries. You know, we do things better in this country. And that's the reason that I always use the chiefs of the four services are very strongly on my side of this issue. It's not being against homosexuals. It's saying if you open up the military as a forum for their cause, whether it's that cause or any other cause, it does a great disservice. And so that's been our position here, and it's worked very well for 17 years.
That issue, gays in the military, that's one of those social issues we're told isn't supposed to be on the top of the minds of Tea Party members. Taxes and the economy are their mantra. Remember, DeMint said the Tea Party wasn't pushing religion. If anything, a Tea Partier might take issue with an Inhofe statement that drew applause here, that he's proud of being a big spender in the area of national defense. So I asked the senator if he saw a difference between the Tea Party and value voters.
No, I don't. I think you see a lot of Tea Party people that are here, and I think that when the speakers are going to mention the Tea Party, which I didn't happen to, but several will, there's an applause. And so I think that they're really pretty much the same people, in my opinion.
The Tea Party has momentum. They certainly have the attention of the press and politicians. So it's not surprising that value voters would want to claim commonality. But what is that common ground? It doesn't seem to be a shared policy. It seems more like an idea of an idea, to take back government. But plenty of conference attendees were sure they stood with the Tea Party and vice versa. Bill Randles of Kansas City, Missouri, says the value voter Venn diagram is stained with tea.
I think a lot of the same people show up at both because people are animated by the same things. I mean, we tend to see the same people, whether we're going to local Republican clubs or to our church or to Tea Party rallies or to events like this.
A few yards from Bill and his wife, Bev Randles, stands Todd Dexter of Plano, Texas. To get to Todd, I have to traverse an array of Duggars, the homeschooled evangelical Christian stars of the reality show 19 and Counting. I can't tell if the four Duggars I step over are Josh, Jana, John, Jill, Jessa, Ginger, Joseph, Josiah, Joanna, Jebediah, Jeremiah, Jason, James, Justin, Jackson, Joanna, Jennifer, Jordan, Grace, or Josie Brooklyn. But eventually I get to Todd Dexter in order to ask him who he thought the Tea Party was.
Well, I think the truth is these people care very deeply about pro-life issues, care very deeply about the sanctity of marriage and kind of the moral values that we believe are the foundation of our country.
You mean the Tea Party believes that? Or?
I believe so. I believe many do. It may not always be the official position, but those who go to those For those who go to those rallies, they very much embrace that.
Dexter has attended Tea Party events. Pollsters bear out his assertion that no matter what slogans the Tea Party vocalizes, a large majority of their members happen to be anti-abortion and anti-gay marriage. One problem is that the Tea Party is much more unofficial than values voters, who at least have established groups like the Family Research Council. They sponsored this conference. It's also true that now is not the time when conservatives are going to be carefully examining the fine gradations among their members. As Glenn Bolger, a Republican pollster, told me before the conference started.
When you have a bad economy, that sucks the oxygen out of almost all other issues.
Far from sucking away oxygen, conservative Republican politicians have wind in their sails. Now's not the time for their backers to question the exact direction of that wind. Just steer the ship to shore. After you win elections, that's when you could figure out how or if you could control the forces that got you there. The Corn Refiners Association, we know they're as corny as Kansas in August, but are they as high as a flag on the 4th of July? I mean, they're trying to rebrand corn syrup.
Whether it's corn sugar or cane sugar, your body can't tell the difference. Sugar is sugar.
High fructose corn syrup will be known as corn sugar if the corn people get their corn way. Audrey Erickson is president of the Corn Refiners Association. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So for purpose of this interview, can I call it high fructose corn syrup, or do you need me to call it corn sugar from now on?
Well, either is fine. Right now, Americans will see high fructose corn syrup on the ingredient label. The challenge is they think it's high in fructose when it's actually not.
It's not high in fructose?
That's correct. In fact, when you walk down a grocery store aisle and you pick up a jar of spaghetti, a whole wheat loaf bread, you're actually getting less fructose than if that product contained sugar. That's because it's using our low fructose sweetener.
So is the message here essentially corn syrup, it's just as bad for you as sugar?
Actually, your body cannot distinguish between table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, and that's the finding of the American Dietetic Association, the nation's leading nutrition experts.
Let me play one other clip. This is part of the branding campaign where you have a series of commercials where people object to high fructose corn syrup, but then you have them essentially not knowing why they're objecting. Let's hear one of those commercials.
Wow. You don't care what the kids eat, huh?
Excuse me?
That has high fructose corn syrup in it.
And?
You know what they say about it?
Like what?
I mean, it's...
that it's made from corn, doesn't have artificial ingredients, and like sugar, it's fine in moderation.
That's the message that you're hitting, that it's fine in moderation, that it's just like sugar. But the part of it where the one mother didn't know what was wrong with corn syrup, for that ad to resonate with people, doesn't that have to be the case? You find that people object to it, but they don't know why they're objecting to it?
Well, and that's the case in this situation. What we have is an ingredient that most consumers don't really understand. They know it's a sweetener made from corn, but then there's been this huge urban legend that's swirling on the internet, and all this stuff that anybody can cook up is thrown at high fructose corn syrup erroneously. You know, corn syrup's been in our grandma's pantry and our great-grandma's pantry and hopefully in our current pantries for generations. It's something that we've grown up with. We understand it. But then along comes this high fructose version. What's that? And that's what's misleading consumers.
And so is the next branding campaign to replace the phrase as American as baseball and apple pie with as American as baseball and corn sugar?
You know,
are you going
we could
that
borrow
far?
You. We could borrow you. I think you have potential.
I got some ideas here. Well, thanks a lot. Audrey Erickson is the president of the Corn Refiners Association. Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you.
We also talked to Michael Jacobson, executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He confirmed that high fructose corn syrup isn't any worse for you nutritionally than sugar, but he did say this.
The term corn sugars, though, may also be misleading, suggesting that the product is kind of squeezed right out of corn rather than being produced through an industrial process.
So corn sugar, by any other name, would taste as sweet. I think we all get that words can lead or mislead, but numbers can, too. Sometimes we give them a pass. Take Joseph McCarthy and his list of 205 known communists in the State Department. Or was it 207? Or 57? Or maybe 81? No one really knew, because McCarthy made up those 205 non-existing communists. He knew that numbers had power. Just as Stephen Colbert coined the word truthiness, meaning pseudo-facts that seem true, there's now proofiness. That's the term journalist Charles Seif came up with to describe deliberately misleading numbers. His new book is Proofiness, The Dark Arts of Mathematical Deception, and Charles Seif joins me now from our New York bureau. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. The McCarthy example, we see it in everyday life all the time, mostly, I find, on the cover of lifestyle magazines. So they'll advertise 27 ab exercises or 245 ways to celebrate summer. And I'm saying, wow, five more ways and you'd have a nice round number. But why in these instances is a nice round number not good for the purposes of the people putting the numbers out?
Well, it's funny because numbers communicate how far you can trust them. And a nice round number is signaling, well, you know, I'm in the area, that it's not a very precise number. But if you've got a really nice precise number, 207, 58, 31, people know that that means exact. And therefore, they believe that it has some real basis in reality, that it's to be trusted.
Let's go to something, a word that maybe you've coined, but disestimation. What's that?
Disestimation is the act of taking a number too seriously and trusting it far beyond the point at which you can stop trusting it.
What's an example of that?
The examples of Joe McCarthy is a good example. Actually, that was an outright lie. But a nice anecdote I like to talk about is a guide at the American Museum of Natural History who's pointing at the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Someone asks, how old is it? And he says, it's 65 million and 38 years old. 65 million and 38 years old. How do you know that? The guide says, well, when I started at this museum 38 years ago, a scientist told me it was 65 million years old. Therefore, now it's the 65 million and 38. That's an act of disestimation. The 65 million was a very rough number, and he turned it into a precise number by thinking that the 38 has relevance, when in fact the error involved in measuring the dinosaur was plus or minus 100,000 years. That 38 years is nothing.
So most of the book Proofiness, you talked about that museum guide, and that doesn't seem like he was trying to deceive anyone or there was anything nefarious there. But Proofiness does have an element of deception. In fact, the subtitle is The Dark Arts of Mathematical Deception.
Absolutely. The dark side of Proofiness is that people who know how to use it are using mathematical techniques, mathematical deception, to convince people of things that are outright wrong. And as a result, it sways policy. It changes the way people vote. It changes the number of voters. It dilutes your ability to communicate your will to the people in power.
Did you come across any examples of proofiness or innumeracy or mathematical chicanery that kind of came by just honestly yet led to a bad result?
I think when journalists, for example, report polls, they just don't know better that they shouldn't take these results literally. Every poll comes with a little number attached to it called the margin of error. And the margin of error is taken as how reliable this poll is, that it's 23% believe that Barack Obama is not born in the United States, plus or minus 3%. The problem is that for these polls, the margin of error only describes one very specific type of error that plagues polls. It comes from taking a small sample of people and projecting it to the entire world. But in fact, when polls go wrong, it's due to a completely different type of error called a systematic error. These are errors that come when the poll isn't set up quite right, that the questions are a bit misleading, or that you choose the wrong sample of people to interview, or people are lying. And these numbers are not reflected in the margin of error. So when journalists report polls, most of which are really not worth the paper they're written on, I think they're kind of innocently performing an act of proofiness, giving the public quasi-fictions in the name of fact. And the preponderance of polls all around the news media is getting more and more and stronger and stronger. You can't go to a news website without seeing a poll on the front page, often an internet poll. Internet polls are completely meaningless, and yet you find them all over in the news media. So I think that the accessibility and the frequency of proofy numbers is fairly new. It's getting worse.
Charles Seif, author of Proofiness, The Dark Arts of Mathematical Deception. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
By day, Susie Hanks works as a morning DJ on a classic rock station in Houston, Texas. But when all the Bachman-Turner has shifted out of overdrive and when the fog hat's been lifted, she donates her vocal talents to Reading for the Blind. There's one particular publication she reads that caught our ear. Producer Brent Bachman picks up the story from there.
The organization is called Taping for the Blind, and it works like this. Volunteers are recorded in a studio reading all kinds of different publications.
Every morning they read the Houston Chronicle front to back, the tabloids, People Magazine.
Those recordings are then aired on a special radio and frequency given to clients.
So you can't hear it on your car radio.
Susie started volunteering there as a reader about 3 years ago.
And the first thing they did was they had me on the pet show. I read Dog Fancy, Cat Fancy, and Bird Talk. It was wonderful, yet a little bit boring, to be honest.
Taping for the Blind does not discriminate in terms of what publications it reads for clients. And one day, Susie got an interesting reading opportunity.
Well, it's a funny story. The guy who did Playboy got married, and his wife told him that he couldn't do it anymore. So they came and asked me. Now, I am a woman on a classic rock radio station in Houston, predominantly male listeners, male fan following, and so they thought that that might be fun. So they asked me if I would give it a try.
Susie reads the articles too, of course, but when she's describing the photos in Playboy, she has no script. She just describes the photos as she sees them.
She has long dark hair, very dark eyebrows, chocolate brown eyes. Her hair appears to be maybe a little bit damp, kind of matted, stuck to the skin. She is rollerblading down the street, and she is looking back over her right shoulder with a great big grin.
She's sitting
face, kind
of Indian style, cross-legged in the water.
She's on a bed. There's some nautical sheets on it, sheets with pictures of sailboats.
Interestingly enough, in the centerfold, it looks as if the tattoos have been airbrushed out. The tattoos are gone. The tattoos are in picture.
Basically, I'm their eyes, and all I'm doing is providing accessibility to what's there on the page. So I read it, or I tell it like I see it. I don't have to try to be sexy when I'm reading the picture. I'm just a woman reading it, and it comes out sexy whether I want it to or not. It's not just body parts. You know, body parts would get boring if I just talked about the body parts over and over and over again. You're painting a picture with your words. She's conveying something through her eyes, through her facial expressions, and through her poses, and that's what I try to do. There are a group of clients who come into Taping for the Blind. I'll walk in and they know my voice. They can tell Susie's here. They perk up and they ask me about an article that I read or tell me a joke that I told them, something like that. My husband never really listened to it before, but the other day I brought one home and I read it to him, and he really liked that. It was a lot of fun. He often tells people that I read Playboy, but he had never actually listened. It was kind of eye-opening for him, too. I was fully clothed when I read that to him, by the way.
Susie Hanks in Houston. She spoke to producer Brent Bachman. You can find out more about the Taping for the Blind service at npr.org. Yeah, the sound of synthesizers, the keytar's more respectable ancestor. Ooh, you thought those synths had gone away, but actually it's a new record by a band that got rich off synths, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, remember OMD? It's not just a revival, listen to who they've got singing with them on this track. Queen of Soul is in the house. Aretha Franklin with OMD. Here to explain how this came to be is Stephen Thompson of the NPR Music website. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, how's it going, Mike?
What is going on here?
This was the song of the day on the NPR website earlier this past week, and it is from the first Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark record in 14 years. Obviously, they're sampling Aretha Franklin. It's sort of what you'd call a mashup of a 1967 song by Aretha Franklin with a 1980 song by OMD. And so they've sort of smashed them together to make this gigantic sort of dance floor filler.
I think it helps both of them a little bit, don't you?
I think so. I think that it sort of takes classic Aretha Franklin and, you know, sort of gives it a little bit of a dancier vibe. And also, obviously, you have the gravitas of Aretha Franklin on this kind of light and airy synth pop band.
All right, Stephen. You also feature a cover song, and it's a Tom Waits cover. And by the way, you're not a musician until you do a Tom Waits cover, right?
They give it to you with the handbook.
Yeah. Right. Let's hear the original Tom Waits song, Long Way Home.
Forgive me, pretty baby, but I always take the long way home.
That's the gravelly Tom that we know. And here now, the duo Mates of State, their take. Mates of State is upbeat, Tom Waits ain't, so maybe that would be a bad pairing, but it works well here. Why?
I think it works great, and I know there are Tom Waits fans who it was like chewing nails listening to Mates of State cover the song with this, yeah, 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 yeah.
And chewing nails is what Tom Waits sounds like. that's spitting them, gargling them, yeah.
What's interesting, though, is if you listen to the songs together, philosophically, I think it's a perfect match for Mates of State. Just this unrelentingly cheerful band with kind of an undercurrent of melancholy that makes the cheer feel kind of hard won.
Yeah, that's it. I think we've stumbled on it. Waits is almost unrelentingly morose, but with glimpses of hope.
Right.
They're the inverse.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
And so they are the inversion of Tom Waits, and I think both are well served. Is a massively polarizing song.
Yeah.
You know, the reader reaction on the website was either, oh, it's so heartfelt and uplifting, or it's just people who just can't believe that they were assaulted with the existence of this cover.
What are you doing to my Waits? I like the sea shanties. That is Mates of State with their version of Tom Waits' Long Way Home, and my guest is Stephen Thompson. He comes in from time to time. He curates the Song of the Day feature on NPRmusic.org. So what's up next?
All right, well, what's next is a hairpin turn from Mates of State. It's a sort of a cranky ethnomusicologist by the name of Lloyd Miller, working with an acid jazz group from the UK called the Heliocentrics, and the song is called Spirit Jazz.
So what makes musicologist Lloyd Miller, why do you describe him as cranky?
Well, he's sort of known in the jazz world as kind of a difficult guy. You know, he's known for writing this fairly well-publicized screed against modern music. And he's an expert in all this world music. He's an expert in Iranian music. And so he's working with this group called the Heliocentric that has also done these kind of fusions of jazz music and world music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found this piece sort of hypnotically enveloping, and I love that we featured it.
Spirit Jazz by Lloyd Miller and the Heliocentrics. And finally, Stephen, we have a new track from the band Blonde Redhead. Now, for you, those of you scoring at home, this is not Four Non-Blondes. This is not Blondie. This is not Concrete Blonde. I don't know why all the bands like to put blonde in the name. This is Blonde Redhead. Tell me about them and the song we're going to hear.
Okay. Blonde Redhead is kind of a downtown New York art rock band. When they started out, they were very, very, very reminiscent of Sonic Youth. Now they've gotten a lot sweeter, and this particular song, which I love, is called My Plants Are Dead.
Well, that does sound sweet, unless you're the plants.
That's right.
Let's listen. Why'd you choose this one as a song of the day?
I think it's really beautiful and very sad. I love the kind of haunting, that very Cure style rumble underneath it is very sweet sounding. But I like the fact that as much as it's kind of this cool, arty, detached, you know, downtown band, there's a lot going on in this song about loneliness and separation and alienation that I think the song captures really well. And if people who love a newer band like The XX, I think would be very well served checking out a, you know, more veteran band doing a lot of the same kind of stuff.
Also people who hate plants.
And also people who hate plants. Yeah.
And that is Stephen Thompson. He's the curator of the Song of the Day feature on nprmusic.org. Check in every weekday for a new song. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Mike Pesca. Guy Raz returns next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend.